1 Samuel chapter 26 tonight. 1 Samuel 26. You know, oftentimes the Lord is working in things that we don't know or we don't recognize till later. Years ago when I was a student in college, I was coming into my sophomore year of college, and my job that I was given as a freshman on campus to help pay my school bill was to work in the campus hospital, which was a bit of an infirmary. They did have some baby births and do some hospital things there, but it wasn't a major hospital. And my job was to work in the hospital and deliver food to patients. Now, in high school, I had done a lot of different things. My first job in high school was working for Wendy's Old Fashioned Hamburgers. And then my second job was working for the Limited ladies' clothing store. I wasn't selling ladies' clothing. My job was to unbox the clothes and put them on hangers so they could be put out on the floor. So I worked in the back room. And then my next job was working for a state senator who was running for Congress. And then my next job was to work at an engraving shop. And then my next job was to work in a factory, basically. So I had a lot of experience doing various things, from driving to sweeping floors in a factory, to engraving, to doing retail, to doing food preparation, and those kinds of things. And what ended up happening is they looked at the list of my experience and they said, we need lots of people to do food stuff. So I got put in the hospital doing the food side of things. It wasn't the job I normally would have just said, oh, that's where I want to work. But it worked out well. It wasn't really a highly stressed job. It worked well with the school schedule. And it's where I ended up working. And what I didn't know was that my sophomore year, a new young lady would end up working there. And I would meet her there, who eventually became my wife, Julie. But we really would not, because we didn't meet our freshman year of college when you have all the basic core classes, you know, when you have speech and English and these kinds of classes that everybody has to take. We didn't meet in any of those classes. So the chances of our meeting from that point on, when she's in this fine arts building and I'm over here in another classroom building, she wasn't taking Greek or Hebrew or biblical themes or any of these other classes. That was almost from my junior year, certainly on, every class I had was all men. There were no ladies in my classes because they were all ministerial classes. And so we wouldn't have met that way. So the Lord arranged it, you know, he was arranging details of where I would work and all of these things to provide a wife. Likewise, we can see the Lord working at other times in our life. A couple years ago, we had the chance to take our teens to Scotland to minister there, and along with the Benders. And Pastor Bender there, Stephen Bender, was very gracious to allow me to preach in their service. And so I preached in the service on a Sunday. And there was a lady that was in that service. And she had started to become acquainted with their church. And I preached a message and included the gospel in it. And that week, and I don't say this to praise myself. What I'm saying is the Lord did this. I didn't know this woman was going to be there. I didn't know anything. I just knew I'm preaching. I want to be sure to give the gospel. I gave the gospel, and that lady came to Christ. Not because of me, but because the Lord was coordinating these events so that she would be there to hear the gospel. And she trusted Christ. And you could see the Lord working. You know, I'd never met her. There was no relationship there. There was no way I would know she was there. And while I preached, I didn't know she was there and didn't know Christ. I just knew I was preaching the gospel, and the Lord used his word in her life, and she came to Christ. And so the Lord was coordinating that. The Lord was arranging that. As we look here in 1 Samuel chapter 26, we see God's hand, again, watching over David, protecting him, and providing for him. 1 Samuel 26, and the Ziphites came unto Saul to Gibeah, saying, doth not David hide himself in the hill of Hakalah, which is before Jeshimon? Now, we found in chapter 24 that these same people, the Ziphites, are the ones who report, their spies report on David. Now, this is interesting because the Ziphites are in the region of southern area of Judah. So these people are actually from David's same tribe, which is a little unusual because these are his same tribe, his people, if you would. And they're turning him over to Saul, probably to be sure that they get special treatment from Saul. There were probably rewards promised. This would have been probably somewhat hurtful to David that they did this to him twice. In other words, imagine if someone was wrongful, if someone wrongfully accused you of some wrong, and then your relatives joined with the wrongful accuser. Think about what that would be like. You get wrongfully accused of something, and it's your relatives who are the ones who join with the people who are attacking you. You'd think, wow, you know, I expect these strangers to treat me this way, but for my family to treat me this way would be unusual. And that's kind of what's going on. And so David really finds himself, and this is the time when he's written some of the Psalms that we may read about being pursued, about being persecuted, and these kinds of things. And you can imagine what these Psalms would have risen out of. Here's his father-in-law trying to kill him, the king of Israel. Here's his fellow tribesmen from Judah who are turning him over. Then Saul arose and went down to the wilderness of Ziph, having 3,000 chosen men of Israel with him to seek David in the wilderness of Ziph. This is not a small group of people. 3,000 men is a sizable army. Now remember, why did the people of Israel want a king? The people of Israel wanted a king because they felt that if they had a king, they would have the ability to have a military response to the Canaanites, to the Philistines, if necessary. Because they felt that just trusting the Lord in it wasn't sufficient. And so they asked for a king. God told them he would give them a king, but not one who was like the Canaanites. They weren't going to have a Canaanite king who would set himself up as a priest and set himself up as a deity and would serve for his own power and would abuse people. They weren't going to have that kind of king. They were to have a king who would recognize that God was the real king and that king was just there to do what God would have him to do. But here, that's not what's going on at all. The real new chosen king of Israel is David. He hasn't yet been installed by the Lord, if you would. Saul has been rejected as king, and what Saul is doing here is he's using his commission to protect the nation to raise an army to actually protect himself and his own power. In other words, he was only supposed to raise this kind of an army when there was a threat from the Philistines, but he's taking this army into the interior of Israel where the Philistines aren't threatening. It's sort of like during the 1770s in America. You know, they stationed British soldiers in Boston. And the king, King George, said, I'm doing this to protect you from the Native Americans. Well, there weren't any threats in Boston. There were some in the frontier area. They weren't there to protect them from Native American threats. They were there to make sure that the colonists stayed in line. Right? And so Saul, again, has raised an army here, not in order to protect the nation from the Philistines, but he's using his power, and this is very Canaanite-like, he's using his power to protect himself, to enrich himself. And Saul pitched in the hill of Hakalah, which is before Jeshimon, by the way, but David abode in the wilderness, and he saw that Saul came after him into the wilderness. David therefore sent out spies and understood that Saul was come in very deed. So he sends scouts out, and they look, and they see it's hard to miss an army of 3,000 people. They don't sneak up on you easily. And David arose and came to the place where Saul had pitched. And David beheld the place where Saul lay, and Abner the son of Ner, the captain of the host. And Saul lay in the trench, and the people pitched round about him. So what we find here is Saul, and he's got the army around him. And they've got their camp set up, and David sees it. And David answered, said unto Ahimelech the Hittite, and to Abishai the son of Zeruiah, brother of Joab, saying, Who will go down with me to Saul to the camp? And Abishai said, I will go down with thee. So David looks down there. Now this is a risky mission that he's asking these men to do. All right, two men to sneak into the enemy camp of 3,000. I mean, you get caught, you're dead. This is you're risking your life to go into here. So David and Abishai came to the people by night. And behold, Saul lay sleeping within the trench, and his spear stuck in the ground at his bolster, but Abner and the people lay round about him. So he's surrounded. To get to Saul is not easy. And here it is at night, the time we would expect. They're asleep, and David and Abishai slip into the camp. Now, one of the things you'll learn about Abishai as we go through 1 Samuel, even 2 Samuel, is that he's the brother of a man named Joab. Okay? So we see here, he says, Abishai, the son of Zeruiah. So he is one of these men who've been with David from early on. He's a valiant man. He's a powerful warrior. And Joab, who ends up being David's chief general during David's time as king, here is his brother Abishai. And they go down, and they see Saul sleeping. Then said Abishai to David, God hath delivered thine enemy into thy hand this day. Now therefore let me smite him, I pray thee, with the spear, even to the earth at once, and I will not smite him a second time. All right. Now, again, if you know something, and you've read these passages before about Joab and Abishai, this is almost always their response. All right? So if you came to Abishai or Joab and you said, I have a problem, they say, who do you need dead? Who should I kill? We'll kill him. Who needs killing? We'll take care of it for you. That's how that was their response to everything. You have a problem, kill him. All right, and that's what we find throughout. These men are men of violence. All right, they make great warriors. They don't make such good men all the time, though, if that makes sense. In other words, yeah, people who are unafraid to kill are great to have in your army, but not always the person you need when ethical decisions need to be made. Okay? And that's what we find with these men. And David said to Abishai, destroy him not, for who can stretch forth his hand against the Lord's anointed and be guiltless? Now, we find in chapter 24, David had found himself in a very similar situation. But there, it's in the cave in En-Gedi, and he finds that Saul comes in to relieve himself in the cave. And David's men say to him at that time as well, hey, the Lord has given him into your hand. Why don't you go kill him? He's your enemy. He's hunting you down. This would be self-defense. Go kill him. But David says, no, this is the Lord's anointed. You can't easily stretch your hand out against the king and kill him. This is God's king. What does that do? What kind of a precedent does that set? If what you say is, if you kill the king, you become the king, what does that mean? It means that you will set off a cycle of violence. And this is not unusual. This happens throughout history. It happens in the world today that, you know, people just decide, I'll kill somebody and I'll take their power. If that person, you know, can't defend his power, then I'll just take it and I'll be the next one. The problem is you got to watch your back at that point, because then somebody else has learned that same lesson. All right, this isn't how you set up a peaceful kingdom that serves the Lord. This is how you grab power and you hold on to it as long as you can. The problem is you don't hold on to that bull for very long. The bull ride doesn't last very long until somebody younger and stronger and more clever comes along and kills you. And so he warns Abishai, this would not be right. Now, he's also learned this lesson not just from sparing Saul in chapter 24, but also from chapter 25 in the story of Nabal, right? Because in the story of Nabal, he's about to go kill Nabal for Nabal's treatment of him and his men. He loses his temper, and God uses Abigail to help spare him from committing this crime. And he sees the Lord then smite Nabal and kill him. The Lord takes care of the issue, the problem for him. In other words, David knows God has promised he will be king. And he knows God has said Saul will eventually lose his throne, and his dynasty will be taken away. So he already knows what God has said. What he needs to do is believe it and not take matters into his own hands by doing something sinful or rash to try to make it come about. Chapter 25 taught him that very clearly. God availed for him when Nabal was, when he was about to kill Nabal. God killed Nabal instead. David said to Abishai, destroy him not, for who can stretch forth his hand against the Lord's anointed and be guiltless? In other words, you can't do this without incurring guilt on yourself. David said furthermore, as the Lord liveth, so here's an oath, the Lord shall smite him, or his day shall come to die, or he shall descend into battle and perish. In other words, something will come from the Lord and he'll die. He'll be like Nabal and die, just suddenly. Or his time will come. He'll live to an old age, but he'll die. Or he'll go into battle and die. Now, that's interesting because he's foreshadowing here what actually happens at the end of this book. Get to chapter 30 or so, and we find out that Saul does go into battle and die there. The Lord does do this. So David says, just trust the Lord on this one. The Lord forbid that I should stretch forth mine hand against the Lord's anointed, but I pray thee, take thou now the spear that is at his bolster and the cruse of water, and let us go. So they're going to take, one, his canteen, and second, his spear. Now, his spear is very important. We have other scenes where Saul is sitting under a tree with his spear and hearing cases of people. In other words, he's holding court. So the spear was the sign of his royal authority. So they're actually taking something very valuable here. It's not only a weapon, but it also showed the sign of his royal authority. And this is not unusual throughout history. Kings have held on to something that showed that they had some kind of authority. All right, the ancient Egyptians would have both a rod and a staff that they would use. Not real ones, but symbolic ones. Why? To show that they're shepherding their people and they have a rod to defend their people, just like a shepherd would use a rod to drive off predators from the sheep. All right, the ancient Romans held a bundle of sticks tied together called a fasces, which was the sign of royal authority, if you would, of authority. That's all through. Even if you go to Washington, D.C., you see those everywhere. The Lincoln Memorial, the chair that Abraham Lincoln sits on, has these two fasces on the front of it, and they're the sign of authority that comes from the ancient Rome. So we still use it even in our government today as symbols of authority. Not because we actually use them for anything anymore. That baton isn't used for any kind of discipline of anything. It's just a symbol. And here, this spear was symbolic of the king's. It was probably not just any spear. It was probably something that was special, specially made for him, that was a symbol of his royal authority. He's the king. He has the kingly spear. This shows that he leads, and what was he called to do? Primarily to defend the nation against the Philistines. So he has this spear to show that he's carrying the spear of the Lord, if you would, to lead them into battle. But this is what David takes. This is interesting. Because what Saul is afraid of is that David wants to take the kingdom. David takes here not the kingdom, but the symbol of the kingdom. Not because he's taking the kingdom from Saul, because to do that he could have just simply killed him. But because he's showing Saul, look, I had the chance to take your life, and here's the proof of it. In other words, this thing is unique. It's not just, oh, hey, I have this spear, and Saul would go, well, is that one really mine? No, it would be clear that this was Saul's spear. So David took the spear and the cruse of water from Saul's bolster, and they gat them away, and no man saw it nor knew it, neither awake, for they were all asleep because a deep sleep from the Lord was fallen upon them. Now, this is interesting. David chooses to go into the camp here, he and Abishai, but the Lord does something. He causes a deep sleep to go on all 3,000 of Saul and his men. The probably best known passage that uses this same phrase, a deep sleep, is in Genesis chapter 2, when God causes a deep sleep to fall upon Adam, and he takes a rib from Adam and uses it to form Eve. Okay, so this is something that comes from the hand of the Lord. This is miraculous. And think about it, God basically does surgery on Adam, if you would. So, you know, it's a painless procedure here. This is basically what's going on. These men are like anesthetized, if you would, miraculously. They're asleep, and they're not waking up because the Lord wants to demonstrate something here. Now, this leads to what I was saying at the opening, and that is that God is working in ways that we don't always notice. The author here, the narrator, tells us this, but we have no indication that David knew it. David just knows he sneaked in. That's all he knows. He doesn't know that God has caused this sleep. It doesn't tell us that he knows this. Maybe he knew it, but it doesn't tell us he knew it. All right? God is working even in ways that David may be unaware of. And the same is true in our own lives, that God is working in ways that we're unaware of. That there are things in our life that go well for us, and it's not merely because of our own skill. It's not just because David and Abishai were great warriors and were able to slip in quietly. Because all it takes is one of 3,000 people to be a little restless that night, and you've got a problem. All right? That's not good odds. All right? So if I, you know, I don't know, what's the likelihood somebody would have insomnia that night among 3,000 people? Say 1 in 1,000 people has insomnia. That means 3 are probably going to be insomniacs that night, and you're going to have a problem. And so that doesn't happen, though. Why? Because the Lord is working on behalf of David here in ways that David doesn't always see. So sometimes even when we're doing something with the gifts and skill God has given to us, we don't notice, nor may we ever know, apart from God telling us, that God was doing far more than we even knew. All right, we must always be aware of this. Not aware of the fact that we know the details of it, but aware of the fact that the Lord is doing things that we never even knew he was doing. That there were things God was working at that, you know, behind the scenes, like the example I used at the beginning. I knew when I was a young man that I would like to find a wife. And I hope the Lord would provide one, but I had no idea how that would happen. All right. You know, as men, we'd like to think our great charming and skill will win us a wife. Our dashing good looks and those kinds of things. So I did need a miracle, but The fact is that, you know, you still need the Lord's providential help. Same thing with the rearing of our children. I often say this, not a single one of us can cause their children or grandchildren or great-grandchildren to believe. We can be examples to them, right? We can tell them the truth, but can you believe for them? We wish we could. We wish we could, but we can't. We can't believe for them. So what do? We tell them the truth and we pray that God will work. That God will open their eyes to see the gospel, the beauty of the gospel, the truth of the gospel. We pray that God will work in their lives. And recognize the fact that there are many young people that grew up in very godly homes and heard the gospel regularly, and unfortunately, some of them never believe. And there are others who grew up in homes that are awful. I know a young man who was preparing to be a missionary to China, and his home was rough. He grew up in a home where his father was an alcoholic and was abusive, and his family just really didn't exemplify Christianity at all. They took him to church every week, but they didn't live like Christians at all. But yet the Lord brought other influences in his life so that as a young man, as a teenager, he heard the truth and the Lord worked in his soul. To the point that later he decided, I think the Lord wants me to go to China and tell other people about Christ. So how did the Lord do that work? Sometimes the Lord does that work in a very nice setting where you have a model Christian home. And sometimes the Lord does that work in places where it just would be unexpected. But nonetheless, the Lord has to do that work. So again, in other words, it would be presumptive of David to say, I'm such a great warrior that I slipped in without any of these 3,000 men knowing. Yes, you did, but God was doing something too, and don't forget that. Don't ever underestimate that the Lord is working at things that we don't know what he's working at times. That, and this is true, what does Paul say when it comes to evangelism? One plants, one waters, and God gives the increase, right? So there are people, many of the people I've led to the Lord didn't come to the Lord merely because I skillfully gave them the gospel. Many of them had heard the gospel many times before. They just happened to hear that time and had been prepared. And there are many people who I gave the gospel to that years later believed when someone else told them, and all I had done is plant. Someone else watered and God gave the increase. And so when it comes to evangelism, we need to remember this. God is the one doing that work and we're dependent on him. All right, we're dependent on him for us. Now, this ought to cause us to take heart, because when God is doing a work, and he's doing a work that he wants to do, whether it's in the evangelism of people, the growth of people spiritually, or in meeting needs in our life, that the Lord does that in ways that we don't often foresee. And he's providentially arranging circumstances and working in situations that we just can't see, can't always know that it's going on, but God is doing it. In other words, let's never forget that God is working. And this, for in their day, this would be easy to understand because they lived in a world that believed very much in the supernatural. They didn't have any question that there was a supernatural world. All right, in ancient Israel, you wouldn't have been able to tell somebody a materialistic view of the universe. You wouldn't have said, there's only the physical world. That's all that really exists. There's no spirits. There's no supernatural. There's no beings, that exist, in the spiritual realm or anything like that. That's just all superstition. There's plenty of people in America that believe that today. But in ancient Israel, that would have been a very, very rare person indeed. In fact, most people would have been much more in tune to the supernatural than we are, sometimes superstitiously so, mostly superstitiously so. So they thought things were spiritual that weren't. The problem is that what happens is in our modern worldview today, we have basically excluded God from things. As if he's not there. As if he doesn't exist. As if he's not working at all. As if everything's explainable materialistically. But yet even the things that are somewhat explainable in the universe, even the things we can observe and explain scientifically, the fact is the timing of them, the design of them, all of those things are still within God's power. Still within God's power. So that, we may say getting rain is normal. Certainly it is. Happens regularly all over the planet, right? But yet the timing of the rain and some of the things that happen because of rain are very much in God's plan. So sometimes they're providential things where God is directing what we would call normal circumstances. Sometimes they're miraculous things like practically anesthetizing 3,000 people so that they could sneak in and take this spear. But God is working, and he's working in ways that we don't see. Now, I want to reiterate this because I want us to understand that we not underestimate this. That there are times, I know, see what happens is, especially in a world like ours where we're very cause and effect oriented, we can say there's this because of this. And we've studied those things out, and we can say, when you do this 90% of the time, this happens. And we can even see patterns in God's work. So Wednesday night, I preached from a passage and illustrated it from the life of David Brainerd. And one of the things we noticed in the life of David Brainerd was that David Brainerd, when he first started preaching to the Native Americans, preached to them in English, even though they didn't speak any English. Well, he didn't see a whole lot of fruit from his labor because they didn't know what he was saying. Because he was preaching in English to people who didn't speak English. Eventually he got a translator, and that made people hear it better, obviously. But the fact is, you can say, all right, missionaries generally find more success if they learn the language of the people they're ministering to. Okay? So we can say generally that's the way it works. The Lord works that way. We can observe it. I read an article a few months ago that was interesting. And it said this. It said, if a church reaches a child, so let's say a church has an outreach for children. If a church reaches a child, 17% of the time, one of the parents will also come to Christ. So if a child comes to an outreach for children and professes faith in Christ, genuinely trusts Christ, 17% of the time, one of the parents will come to faith in Christ. If a church reaches the wife in a family, 70% of the time, the husband and children will come to faith in Christ. If the church reaches the husband, 92% of the time, the wife and children will come to faith in Christ through surveys that have been done. Now, does the Bible promise that? No, but we do see that sort of as a biblical pattern, don't we? That if you reach Lydia, her household believes. If you reach the Philippian jailer, his household believes. Okay, so we can observe some patterns, but that's just a pattern. It's not a promise, right? If 17% of the time, what that means is that there's still, you know, almost one-fifth of the time, one-sixth of the time or so, that if you reach the child, one out of six times, you're going to reach one of the parents. But if you reach the husband, 9 out of 10 times, you're going to reach the rest of the family. Statistically. But God is working in all kinds of scenarios and all kinds of situations. We can see things that are cause and effect, but what we have to remember is that God is working, and that just because there's some things that are predictable or there's some things that are cause and effect, that we not leave God out of it. In other words, nobody reaches anybody apart from the Spirit. If the Spirit of God isn't working in people's hearts, it doesn't matter those statistics. Those statistics won't hold up. Those are just observations based on studies and things of that nature. We need God's help and God's work and all of these things. And David needed God's help and God's work. And we see here verse 13. Then David went over to the other side and stood on the top of a hill afar off, a great space being between them. So he goes over to the other side to another hill. And David cried to the people and to Abner, the son of Ner, saying, "Answerest thou not, Abner?" So he cries. Now, Abner's the general, and Abner's first responsibility would be to protect Saul. In the ancient world, you killed the opposite side's king, you win the battle. So you cannot let Saul die. You have lost the battle if you let Saul die. So Abner, as the chief military general, his job is first and foremost to make sure that there's a bodyguard for Saul. Now, he's obviously failed at this, because David and Abishai could have killed Saul right there. Then Abner answered and said, "Who art thou that criest to the king? Who are you? Identify yourself." And David said to Abner, "Art thou not a valiant man?" In other words, aren't you a hero in Israel? Aren't you a great warrior? "And who is like thee in Israel?" In other words, who's your equal? "Wherefore then hast thou not kept the Lord thy king? For there came one of the people in to destroy the king thy Lord." He says, "Well, how come you didn't protect Saul? This thing is not good. that thou hast done. As the Lord liveth, ye are worthy to die, because ye have not kept your master, the Lord's anointed. And now see where the king's spear is and the cruse of water that was at his bolster. He says, remember what the law says. You fail at your duties in protecting the king, you can be given the death penalty. All right, this is, we know from the ancient world, that if a guard failed at his duty, it was the death penalty. You could be executed for not protecting what you were told to protect. I don't know what the... I know it's not capital punishment these days, but I don't know what the punishment is for falling asleep on guard duty in the military. You're going to get in trouble, and a lot of trouble, because that's really important. All right, for some of our men who are stationed and women who are stationed in Afghanistan, there are some people who, in the middle of the night, have to be awake watching certain things. You can't have them falling asleep. You can have a lot of dead people if they do. That's taken very, very seriously. Here, they're all asleep, because God has caused the sleep to come upon them. They're all asleep, and they're unable to protect Saul. And so David's basically saying, he's not saying, I hope they kill you. What he's saying is, you failed, and remember how high the consequences are for a failure like this. This is a very serious thing. And he says, look, here's the king's spear, it's identifiable, and here's his canteen, if you would. Here's his store of water. And Saul knew David's voice. Remember, David's his son-in-law. He's been around David a lot at this point. And said, is this thy voice, my son David? And David said, it is my voice, my lord, O king. Now notice again, David shows respect to Saul throughout. And he said, wherefore doth my lord thus pursue after his servant? For what have I done, and what evil is in mine hand? In other words, why are you chasing me? What have I done? I haven't done any crime. Now therefore, I pray thee, let my lord the king hear the words of his servant. If the Lord have stirred thee up against me, let him accept an offering. But if they be the children of men, cursed be they before the Lord. For they have driven me out this day from abiding in the inheritance of the Lord, saying, go, serve other gods. He's saying, basically, you've driven me out from my people, and it's like they're telling me to go to serve other gods rather than the Lord, that I don't have a part with the Lord's people anymore. And whoever's turned you against me has done so unfairly. Now, therefore, let not my blood fall to the earth before the face of the Lord. In other words, don't let my blood be shed, for the king of Israel has come out to seek a flea. All right, obviously that's a silly picture here, but there are plenty of fleas in the world. You don't put 3,000 men together to go on a flea hunt. Where's that one flea? We have to get it. It's unimportant. That's his point. David's saying, I'm not important. I'm not a bother. There's no reason to come after me. And then he goes on and he uses actually a play on words here. And he says, as when one doth hunt a partridge in the mountains. All right? There's a play on words. The phrase partridge in the mountains in Hebrew sounds like the phrase one who calls from the mountains. So what did David do? He stood on one mountain and he called over to Saul and to Abner. And he says, Abner! And he's saying, this is like pursuing a partridge. Isn't that big a bird? It's pursuing a partridge through this wilderness. You're not going to get, your quarry isn't worth the chase. All right? The animal you're trying to, there's easier prey. Why would you do this? Then said Saul, I have sinned. Now notice we see Saul's brokenness again. But again, it's not trustworthy because this happened two chapters ago. Right? David says, I could have killed you. Saul says, you've been more righteous than me. Surely you're going to be the king of Israel someday. And, you know, I'm sorry for chasing you. And Saul turns around. But here we are two chapters later, and Saul's in pursuit again. Right? We don't know how many years pass between this. But eventually, Saul comes back to this. He says, I have sinned. Return, my son David, for I will no more do thee harm, because my soul was precious in thine eyes this day. Behold, I have played the fool and have erred exceedingly. Saul says, I was wrong. I've acted like a fool. In other words, who's more faithful to Saul here, David or Abner? Abner fell asleep, and David could have killed Saul, but he spared his life. David was actually a more faithful servant to the king. He recognized the king's office more clearly than Abner even did, because Abner fell asleep on the job. And David answered and said, behold the king's spear, and let one of the young men come over and fetch it. In other words, they would have these young boys who were armor bearers and other things. He's saying, send one of those messengers over here and I'll return these things. He had no intention to keep them. He's not trying to claim the throne by taking this. He's taking it as evidence. And the Lord render every man his righteousness and his faithfulness. He said, let the Lord judge here. For the Lord delivered thee into my hand today, but I would not stretch forth mine hand against the Lord's anointed. But you're the one who's been chosen by God to be king of Israel, and God's the one who put you there. God will be the one who takes you out of there. I'm not going to be the one to do it. That wasn't my job. In other words, we would have been, as David recognizes, a guilt in verse 9 to kill Saul here. Because it's treason against the king. Even though the king's hunting him, he's saying this wouldn't be the right thing to do. And so what David's saying is, we trust the Lord in these matters. We don't go and sin against the Lord. Even though it seemed like, as Joab, Abishai, and others often say, look, the Lord has delivered him into your hand. The situation's going well. It has to be from the Lord. See, that's part of the point of this passage. Not everything that looks like it's fortuitous is from the Lord, and not everything that looks difficult means the Lord isn't working. It's not easy to slip into a camp of 3,000 men, but the Lord was working in it. And it's not easy to spare Saul here, but the Lord is working in it. And what we're seeing is in other words, who would you rather have a king? A man who uses the power of the kingship to hunt his personal enemy, or a man who shows mercy and respects God's leading? Certainly, the one who shows mercy and respects God's leading is the more gracious of the two, is the one that's actually acting like the king. What we're seeing is a shift. Saul is the king, God rejects him, but in that process, as we move further and further, we find that David's looking more and more like the king, even though he's not officially the king yet, and Saul is looking less and less like the king. There's a process going on here. And behold, as thy life was much set by this day in mine eyes, so let my life be much set by in the eyes of the Lord, and let him deliver me out of all tribulation. The Lord said, just as I respected your life today, I pray that the Lord will show respect to my life and deliver me from the hunt that you've come after me. Now notice what Saul says. Then Saul said to David, blessed be thou, my son David. Thou shalt both do great things and also shalt still prevail. Now he doesn't go as far as to say you're going to be king someday like he did previously in chapter 24. But what he says here is, you know, God's blessing you and he's going to continue to bless you. So David went his way and Saul returned to his place. And so we see Saul breaks off the chase of David here. But what we wonderfully see is the Lord working. He's working to remove Saul. He's working to lift up David. And he's working even in small things like keeping men asleep. God's work is there. God has caused this. The narrator has told us. And we see God's blessing on the life of David in this passage. We see how David has developed. In chapter 24, he thinks about killing Saul. He cuts off part of his garment, and then he feels bad even about that disrespect. So he's kind of toying with it at the beginning of chapter 24, but he doesn't go through with it. Chapter 25, he loses his temper, and he's about to kill Nabal, but the Lord intervenes by sending Abigail, and he learns that by withholding his anger, the Lord deals with the problem without David having to sin. Then he gets to chapter 26, and we see this very mature response of David. Chapter 24, he almost sins, but he doesn't. Chapter 25, he's about to sin. In fact, he has every intention of sinning, but God keeps him from doing it. Chapter 26, he never even says, hey, maybe I should do this. He says to Abishai, no, this wouldn't be right. He's the Lord's anointed. We've seen maturing in David's life here. All right? And we can see that in the life of a believer, that there are times when we're growing spiritually, there are things that we say, should I do this or shouldn't I? And we think, well, no, I don't think the Lord would have me to do that. And later in our life, we just give the automatic answer. No, I know that's not right. I've learned that one. Right? I've already learned this spiritually, and that's what we see here in the life of David. And in the midst of it, God is working. You know, so as we look at, David was in a very difficult circumstance here. Being hunted by 3,000 men is not an easy circumstance. It wasn't easy to see God's work going on. And there are many times in our life that there are things going on that it's not always clear how the Lord is working. But just as David trusted the Lord to work this situation out and protect him, so we need to trust the Lord in the various situations he puts us in. That I know, sometimes, you know, we will have people personally attack us. Maybe not physically attack, but you get personally attacked. Your character's called into question. Your life is called into question. People try to get revenge on you for something. And in that process, you know, it's tempting for us to want to do what David is tempted to do in chapter 24, and that is solve the problem. Just solve the problem. To do it like Abishai here. Just, who should I kill? You know, somebody does something bad enough to us, we start to think, how do I get rid of them? How do I, and I don't necessarily mean by that you're contemplating murder, but you start to think, how can I ruin their life? How can I turn people against them? How can I get revenge? How can I, and the vast majority of those thoughts are evil and sinful. And when we try to take that kind of personal revenge, like David's being urged to do here, we forget that God is working. That there are people that get mad at us, that try to do things to harm us, to do things to spoil things in our life. And it's very tempting to want to try to balance the scales ourselves and forget that God is working. And the Lord calls on us to trust him in the midst of these kinds of situations. May we learn, as David learned here, if we get to this third chapter in this series of David's enemies being dealt with by God, may we learn, as David learned, to trust the Lord and to see God's working in the midst. Let's bow our heads. Our Heavenly Father, we thank you for this passage of Scripture.